This episode of the No Film School podcast is sponsored by MusicBed. MusicBed believes everyone should have access to great music in their projects, regardless of their budget or workflow. That's why they just announced their all-new membership program, the first music licensing subscription of its kind, releasing this summer. Membership is here to make their world-class roster of artists and composers available for all of your projects. Membership will give you unlimited access to a majority of MusicBed's artists, all at a flat monthly or yearly rate based on the types of films you make. And if you still want single-use licenses, they're not going anywhere. Membership is just a new option to make licensing work better for your workflow. Be one of the first to learn more at musicbed.com/membership. And don't forget, you can get 20% off your next on-site license with coupon code NF20. Hi, this is Oakley Anderson Moore, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Sometimes the rhythm, the humor, the drama, even the entire plot of a film only starts to work in post-production. And while some people prefer to wax poetic about how a film was shot than say how it was edited, which may be in part because editing by definition is about being invisible, many filmmakers remember post-production as that murky, magical realm where their film came to life. At this past Sundance Film Festival, I sat down with a handful of editors, animators, and colorists who basically live in that realm. In part one of this conversation, you'll hear mostly from editors on their process of turning a jumble of pictures and sounds into an award-winning film. This is Oakley from No Film School, and I'm really excited about the conversation we're about to have. I'm at the Sundance Film Festival sitting down with a bunch of people, editors, colorists, and animators, and we're about to talk about post-production. Because if you think that you can just shoot a bunch of footage and turn it into a film that gets into Sundance, you are way off. So thank you everybody for being here. I'd love to just go around the room and have you introduce yourself. Tell us what you do, what film you're with, and whether you're an editor or a colorist or an animator, let us know what appealed to you. How did you get attracted to this field to begin with?
Cool. Yeah. Hey, great to be here. This is Ninev Laura Minier. I'm with 306 Hollywood. I'm the editor, one of the editors on the film. The director's also edited, as well as the composer did some editing. So it was a real team collaborative effort. But I was on the project about 2 years off and on. And how did I come to the project?
How did you end up becoming an editor? What is it about that you, maybe not necessarily how you got there, but what appeals to you about it? Thought I'd lead with the hardest question.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm the first one off the bat. Okay. So editing, the minute I saw an edit room, I wanted to edit. It was like love at first sight. And I'd started out in production, and there was just there was something about the an Avid suite. It was like something like the space, not the space shuttle. It's the Houston headquarters where the lights and all the mixing tables. I mean, that was when the edit suites were huge and bright lights and everything.
You wanted to push all the launch buttons.
Yeah. You didn't know what any of the buttons did, and so. But the thing that really appealed to me was just the. There's something about science and art that blends in editing. And so, of course, editing is making worlds and making realities. And that's really appealing to me. But it allows, so many aspects of my interests and my, how I see the world to exist simultaneously. It's not just art. It's not just, dependent on whatever the topic is. You're kind of employing everything to make a world. So that's really what appealed to me.
Awesome.
Hello, I'm Patrick Lawrence, and I'm the editor of the feature film Clara's Ghost, as well as the short film Men Don't Whisper. I would say that I became an editor because I wanted to be a director, like most people in college at my time, and I was pretty intimidated by the amount of people that I met that were wanting to do simpler things. And so I ended up taking a few video production courses real early on in college when DV tape was still a thing and we were ingesting and cutting digitally and it hadn't become so mainstream, and that became appealing to me. And over the years, I just kept tinkering with it in video podcasts and things like that. And so when I finally finished college a few years later, I decided to just jump full into film production. And I think what appealed to me most about it was an extension of directing for me. Because whereas I necessarily as a director, like I have stories that I like to tell and a vision of some kind, I don't necessarily think it's the most unique vision, the most creative vision, but working with writers and directors who do have those visions and being able to kind of feed off of them and see how they see the world and then help shape their films where they can't see how to put it together, that was appealing to me. It was an extension of directing. The way I interpret editing as a whole is basically like big puzzle pieces. And I've never been a puzzle person at all. I've never been a person to say, hey, there's a 1,000-piece puzzle over there. Let's go put it together. But the way I interpret my workflow is basically taking these huge, unnatural puzzle pieces that aren't meant to go together and somehow making something out of nothing that tells a story. And I've been lucky enough to have been here twice now. I've had 4 films in the festival. And I'm glad that those pieces fit together for the people that saw them.
So yeah, next up, Sam Daly. I am definitely curious about how a colorist becomes a colorist. So make sure to tell me.
Okay. My name is Sam Daly. I am a colorist. I graded 4 films that are at the festival this year. I actually have to write them down, make sure I get everybody. 2 that are in competition, Tyrell and Sorry to Bother You, and 1 movie that premiered last night at the Midnight shows, Piercing. And there's a premiere of a movie called Beirut that I also graded, which will be released through Bleecker Street on April 13th. So they're one of the few that already has a release date here at Sundance. Cool. I got into color, I think, similar to how Patrick got into editing, whereas I came out of film school thinking above the line, and I couldn't find something that stuck. I tried, music video directing, and I tried all these things, and I needed a job. And I had some experience running the camera department at my university, and so I kind of knew cameras and photography and cinematography. And I got a job at a lab, doing all things sound transfer, so like nothing, but I needed a job. And I worked production for a little while right out of school, and it just wasn't for me. I was nowhere near set. I was doing lock-offs. I just didn't feel like I was part of filmmaking. I was like just collecting a day rate. And so I did sound transfers, and then I moved to New York, and I needed another job, and I had experience at a lab, so I got a job at Duart, which was, at that time in the 90s, was a seminal house for independent film. Especially, there were, I think, 6 Sundance winners that came out of Sundance. I'm sorry, came out of Duart that year, the years that I was there. And I did audio. I synchronized audio on the graveyard shift.
Nice.
And while still trying,
wants,
still
right?
trying to be, a director and writing and then I found myself hanging out with all the other colorists, and a lot of colorists there at the time had broadcasting backgrounds, and they didn't know how to read a camera report. Now my lab experience and also my from working in the camera department at my university. I knew what a chocolate filter should look like, and they should not time it out. And so I would be giving, I'd be sitting down, just shooting. Can I curse?
Yes.
Shooting the shit with these colorists, and on the daily shift overnight, and saying, "Oh no, that's a coral filter. You can't balance that out." And be telling, "Oh, the reason why it's so stroby is because they have a 180. They close down to a 90-degree shutter." I spent all my time there annoying these colorists. And then finally I said, can I train to be a colorist? And it just meant longer time on the graveyard shift. And I did commercial dailies for years, and then, changed companies and did, commercial work, and then moved companies again and got into features. And that's where I really felt I got connected with the people that were creating the content. And I spoke the same language as a lot of feature and narrative filmmakers. And I've been able to go back and forth between feature film and television and some short form. I occasionally do promos and commercials and music videos. But I really connect with filmmakers, and I feel like a filmmaker. Even though I'm not above the line, I feel when I'm there in my theater, that I'm a contributor and they're trusting me, and I'm like Patrick said with the puzzles. I mean, I'm putting together, you know, the colors for them and making it, and I'm also feel like I'm the first audience member. So they've been stuck in an edit room for so long, and maybe the DP hasn't seen a cut in 6 months, and so I'm sort of in the middle. I'm like, no, this is, we should go here, and this is how I'm reacting to it. And so I'm the diplomat in many cases. So that was a long route, but I've been doing this a long time. So.
Oh, that's cool. Interesting path. Nat, you're also a colorist. Is your experience similar? Elaborate.
Just to start with my introduction, my name is Nat Jenks, and like Sam, I'm gonna use my little cheat sheet. But worked on 5 films this year. Juliet Naked, which is a Jesse Peretz film, and Madeline's Madeline. It's Josephine Decker's new film here at the festival. Nancy, which premiered yesterday. Miseducation of Cameron Post, and A Kid Like Jake. In terms of how I got into color, similar in some ways, but very different in others. Like similar in that, started working in the vault at a commercial facility, scanning barcodes and checking things into a FileMaker database, and was totally unsuited to it. And through like a very long and convoluted path that's probably too long to get into, sort of meandered my way from that through editorial and visual effects and title design, and maybe 10 years later found myself working for Steven Soderbergh, who I worked with for 6 years. When I was working for him, we, for lots of complicated reasons, we were working on a film called Che, which is one of the first films shot on Red. And for complicated reasons, we ended up doing everything in-house and buying all of our own DI equipment and kind of building our own DI facility. So I found myself in a position where for the first time I had all these tools at my disposal, which for the way that I learn and like to, my learning style is much more, if I have something available to me and I can play with it, I love to like play around and tinker with things. So that was kind of my entree into doing color work. And I knew that, I have a photography background, and doing photography, I always found like the dark room to be the place that I really enjoyed being, and like found that end up taking pictures of like fairly mundane landscapes and found objects, and then spending like ages in the dark room like playing around and like seeing what I could do with it. That piece of the process is something that's always interested me a lot.
My name is Keiko Deguchi. I'm here with Weedy Animal. I'm the editor. So the way I started, I was at NYU. I didn't go to a film school. I went to cinema studies. I wasn't thinking going to film production. I was thinking to going back to Japan and thinking maybe distribution or something. That would be kind of cool. Come to film festival and pick up films. And that was back in 80s when American independent film was just coming up, like hundreds. So I thought it was a really exciting time doing that kind of stuff. And then the distribution company made a first film in Japan. And they said, do you want to come? So I said, yeah, sure. And they didn't have any money, but I went anyway. And I was the apprentice editor. And I just fell in love. And it's back when we were still editing in film. So we had all these boxes, labels, and what we call cinetubes. I don't know. I'm sure none of you know, but we kind of hang these films on the thing called cinetubes, and we make those things and nice and neat. So it had this very tangible craft-like feel to it, which I really loved. Unlike Patrick, I love puzzles. And I'm excited about 1,000-piece puzzles. And I do think editing is much more like puzzles. And that's really, like, when I see this footage and try to figure out how to put them together, that's what really excites me.
Very cool. And we also have some other people from We the Animals. I should say to the people listening, Keiko showed up and she rolls pretty deep because I swear like 15 people from the post-production on that film, and some of which are listening and some of which are here. So you guys, please introduce yourselves and give us a say.
My name is Seth Reichert and I'm a colorist at RCO. We're a small facility. I guess I got into color in a super roundabout way. First,
as if these guys weren't roundabout.
I think even more roundabout, actually.
Okay.
I think I did pretty much every other job. So I started out going to school for creative writing and decided that wasn't for me. So then I started doing web design and worked for a company in the city that did web design and motion graphics when I was 18. And that was a funny experience when you're the only person in the office that can't drink yet. And then I got into motion graphics there from web design. And then I got hired by a company called Digital Kitchen in Chicago after that and moved out there. We did a lot of show titles. And I started shooting a lot as well. Moved back to New York and freelance doing motion graphics there. And then started doing compositing and shooting as well. So that's similar, I guess, in your case. And then when I was doing compositing, I really loved the color side of it and, you know, tweaking shots in terms of the color. So then as I was doing that and I was shooting more, I started shooting for a company called Buck that does motion graphics and animation in New York. And I built out a suite there and I worked at night on friends' music videos and films and stuff like that. And I really cherish the relationship with directors and how I can help chaperone them to achieve the vision they want, as opposed to having to dictate what other people should do. Like, I could dictate that on technical terms, but in terms of creative, I wanted to help them find their way, as opposed to other career paths I could have chosen, where if I was doing art direction, I would tell someone else what to do. And I really liked helping the director find their path. And I'm a good problem solver, as all of you guys are. So I liked picking things apart and putting them together, and color is a fantastic way to do that. And then I would work at night. My wife would be kind enough to bring me a change of clothes in the morning, so no one at work would realize what I had just been doing. And I'd have
clients come in at night. So when you were bringing your friends in at night, that was off the clock, like sneaking them in to use it.
Exactly. Okay. Nice. No, but my boss was really kind and was totally cool with that. Very supportive.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And, but I didn't want them to realize how sleep deprived I was for the other job that I was supposed to be doing. So I would go meet my wife at the train station and pick up a bag of clothes, go back to the office and change. Then people would come in and be like, yeah, I just got in a little while ago, and I'd be having coffee. And then I was able to build up enough clients to start my own company. Then I've been working on films. This is the fifth Sundance that I've been to with films. I worked on We the Animals, and I worked on an episodic series called The Trade for Showtime. That's awesome. My path.
I like that you mentioned the problem solvers, because I really think that film people in general, whether on set or in post, are some of the best problem solvers I've ever met in my entire life, especially the crew people.
Yeah, absolutely.
It also seemed like we could be like have a second job as like FBI investigator. Like, hey, I always kind of thought, like, I think I could do that.
Yeah, actually, maybe you guys should be applying the skills to something.
I think a lot of that is hubris too. I think all of us like think we can do anything, and then we get ourselves into these boxes that we have to find our way out of, and that's how we learn a lot, you know.
That's very cool. Yeah. So Mark, the last one, if you introduce yourself, you're the one animator we have here. And yeah. I'm curious to hear from you. Just tell us a little bit.
Yeah, so my name is Mark Samsonovich. I design the animation and the illustration for We the Animals. I don't really have like a long history of how I got into animation. This is the first film I've ever worked on. And and the first time I've ever done animation. I've never done it prior to working on this film. I'm a painter based in New York. I got put in touch with Jeremiah because he was looking for an illustrator, someone to design Jonah's like imaginary illustrated world. And I was like sort of hesitant at first because I don't normally take on like design jobs. I really like just doing what I want to do and working in my studio. But I took a phone call with Christina, one of the producers, and then I met with Jeremiah in a coffee shop. He was with his kid and he had his laptop, and he like showed me one scene of the film on his laptop on mute while his kid was like crying, and that one scene was like so powerful, even you know despite the circumstances, and I just felt like there was something special there. So I ended up taking on the project, and it was like pretty smooth. I think the first time I came back to Jeremiah with drawings, like samples of like what his world could look like. He was like, "That's spot on," and then I spent a few weeks just designing this journal. It was a prop. I designed a couple of journals in total, but we filled every page, and then at some point in the process, I think during shooting the winter session, we both realized that this should become animated. I think I've always had like a prior interest in animation. I kind of knew that I'd get into it at some point in time. I didn't know how. And Jeremiah's definitely fiddled with it before in his work. It came about pretty naturally, I think. And then what was supposed to be a 3-week project turned into a year long animation job. that's how it all started for me.
Very cool. And you know, to explain to listeners, We the Animals is about three young kids, and they're kind of growing up under difficult circumstances. And the youngest in the film sort of escapes into this world he creates, and part of that is shown, you know, what he's creating then becomes animated yeah. worlds and stuff. So I'd love to ask you and Keiko what the process was, like in terms of editing. Did you start editing once all of this animation come in? And I know there's a lot of other things in the film that are very unusual and are otherworldly. Talk to us about how the editing process was in regards to incorporating those elements.
Right. So that was one of the hardest thing about the editing. The reason it took so long to edit because Mark didn't come on until January, I guess. Yeah, January. And we start shooting in July the year before. So for all the time, we didn't know what his drawing was going to look like, what it was going to be. So we were kind of working in this imaginary space. Also, we didn't have shot of him drawing even. So I had complete this blank spot. And that's his world, which is essential to the film. So yeah. We were like trying to find the film without the most important scene in the film, basically. So that was the hardest part until we got Mark to start drawing. And then even after he started drawing, we didn't start animating until May or something.
A month ago. Yeah.
So, you know, and then like when Jeremiah said animation, I was like, animation? I don't really see it because the film is very natural, documentary-like, and animation just didn't sound right. And I was kind of doubtful it's going to work. But when we first saw what Mark did, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, it's very natural, organic kind of stuff that Mark did, so.
I mean, I think it was a pretty strong collaboration between you, me, and Jeremiah for like 6 months. You know, I came in and I saw the rough cut, probably the roughest cut, and like we were kind of deciding. You and Jeremiah were deciding where to, you know, put animation, where it should go, and really also like what purpose does it serve? You know, there was some things that, like, yeah, some moments where, like, there's, I guess, Jonah is seeing a different part of reality than what, you know, his, than what the audience is seeing in the film. And yeah, I think what ended up happening was I made some animatics, some mock-ups for the animation. We put them in, and then the edit shifted around, and then we threw those mock-ups out and redid them, put them into different places, and yeah, it was like that, I guess.
I just want to add one thing.
Yeah.
So animation was extremely helpful once we got it, because it was the thing that we could say, oh, we can do animation to solve this problem, right, in a way.
Right.
You know, once you finish shooting, obviously you don't have that much choices to do that. But with animation, we could add another storyline almost. So yeah, it was amazing to have that.
Yeah, and Mark, you know, this is your first time doing animation. So I'm just curious, like, what did you use that you learned so quickly how to do it? You know what I mean? Like,
I think, like, what we all share here is like this
problem solving.
Ability. Yeah, yeah, no, for real. And like, I love learning craft. Like, I build furniture, I make clothes. It's just something that I love getting into, something that's in some way complex. That's not my shirt, but I can't knit. But you know, yeah, no, I love learning new crafts, and animation just felt approachable to me, especially the style of animation for this film. You know, it's all done with like crayons and paper. You know, it is done as if a child did it. So in that respect, it's not like I'm entering a Disney production studio and like starting day one. So yeah, I mean, like, there's things with like motion. There's, at first, some of the motions that we were doing were simple. You know, there was only one perspective involved. And then over time, you know, as we got more involved in like, you know, like the narrative qualities of the animation, I started exploring like different kinds of techniques and different kinds of perspectives in the animation process. So yeah, I think it's a pretty approachable line of work. As long as you can, you know, you have a certain level of competence and problem-solving abilities.
Cool. So it's so interesting hearing about this process, because especially knowing that your director had worked in documentary in the past, I think this is his first narrative, and hearing how, like, the story was still coming together in fundamental ways at the end kind of, to me, sounds like something that's common a lot in documentary. So I feel like this could be a good thing to bring up with Nev about 306 Hollywood, which is a documentary, but I should say it's not like any documentary that I've ever seen. It's a magical realist documentary. It follows two siblings who go into the house of their dead grandmother and reanimate her objects into this like big meditation on life and death. And there's like dance sequences and all this interesting, bizarre stuff. Can you talk to us about, you know, being the editor on a project like that, which is sort of like has all the elements of a traditional narrative, but has potentially this documentary aspect where you're still finding the story? Or if you don't even think that's true, you could say that, and that's the same in narrative. So
yeah, Alan and Jonathan Bogarin, the directors, they had a sense of what it could be. They always knew, they had a clear sense of what magical realism meant to them. When I started on the project, I didn't really know what that meant. So then it was a matter of like creating a language to understand, and we would have these whole debates about what is magical. That's not magical. That's, you know, that's more fantasy, or that's, you know, fairy tale, or that's. So we started to have to really dissect, like, literal language to understand how our visuals connecting to how we understand things, and how do we create then those visuals, and create a storyline. So they had 10 years worth of interviews with the grandmother, and maybe about like 8 hours of material. And then they would start to shoot the objects in the house. They have a very strong visual arts background in photography and painting, and a kind of an aesthetic that's just really rigorous, like the way they frame everything, their color choices, and how they just set up shooting like a radio that they would find in the house. They'd found like 20 radios, and they would put them on different color tablecloths and like it was just so specific. But then we just had all these objects and we didn't really know, like, okay, what is the basic story? And, like, it's so interesting to hear the process of We the Animals, because it's like, how do you understand what an emotional arc can be if you're missing these elements? And how do you trust that you can hit these emotional tones until you have all of your elements? So the edit room really was this kind of a laboratory of experimenting. And I'd never worked on any process like this before. It was scary and crazy, and we didn't know if it would work. And we dove in and then just started creating sketch after sketch of ideas of for scenes, which then we started to kind of understand where they could come and in the arc. And we understood that it was then more about the directors excavating, literally excavating. But the experimental lab part was really just that we'd have an idea for a scene and then just really rough visuals. And then they'd have to go shoot stuff based on what the process revealed in the sketch. And then we'd bring those images back. And luckily it was only in Jersey. It was like a 30-minute drive. They could go and spend like a half a day and grab some stuff. And so the house was a lab and the edit room was a lab. And then we just keep going back and forth. And like suddenly these scenes would take on different shapes that we couldn't predict ahead of time. And sometimes they would just pop and sometimes they would be flat and like, okay, how do we crack that? And it would really depend on like a single image sometime. Or creating, you know, they did all these upside down lens images just for the hell of it at one point. And they were beautiful and weird. And we're like, okay, we got to use them somewhere. And somehow with the storytelling, like tropes that we use, we knew like fairy tale was a really important device that would inspire how we tell the story. So we came up with this concept of a portal that made a lot of sense for their characters to enter a portal. And it was like, oh, we have these upside down lenses. Great. And then, you know, then they would shoot more that were more abstract. And so some of it came from the material that was there that would just be this associative, random, like chance discovery. And then we would create a whole scene around that. And others came, were much more scripted. And then they'd go shoot like these lip syncs based on these tapes that they found of their family from the 70s fighting. So that was really, they knew they wanted to create these lip syncs with these actors in the same clothes, in the house, with the same plates. But we didn't know what we were going to do with them for like a year.
Yeah, I mean, for the other editors, how much does that, have you worked on projects where something like this is similar, where you're essentially coming up or writing the story as the editor? You know, does this, are there certain projects where you feel like that as well? Is this something that's more common in documentary versus narrative? Like, what are your experiences in terms of I'm writing the story in the edit room as we speak?
I went through a bit of that this past year working on another feature called Silicon Beach, which is world premiering at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. And that was one that we really shaped the film in the edit. I thought it was a wonderful script. And my first pass of the film I thought was really great as well. And we just found that some things were working better shifted around. And that included, you know, your order of days in your story, flipping those around and hoping nobody notices the costume changes and stuff like that. But it told a stronger story ultimately in the end. And that was a good example of that. For me on Clara's Ghost, I feel bad because the biggest animation thing we had to do was a nail break. And the only reason we had to do that was because it just didn't look real enough when we shot it. And so there was a lot of arguments on set about whether or not we should reshoot it. And just because we were so tight on time, it didn't happen. And I had to assure the producers and the AD, oh, we can animate this. We can cover it up with color. I had no idea how, but I assured them that we would. And we found this really amazing visual effects artist, Matt Lathrum. And I described to him exactly what it needed to be because it just looks like a fake fingernail that snaps in half. And what he sent back was incredible. And even watching it on the big screen here at Sundance, I was like, I can't believe that's a fake fingernail. But that was the extent of our animation problems, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting. Kiko, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, sure. Well, with documentary, obviously it's 100%. Everything happens in the editing room, writing and structuring and all that. With the animals, actually, was somewhat similar. It was a very fluid script. the way I describe. So the scenes, we took shots from everywhere. We took scenes from everywhere. And Jeremiah, because he also has a documentary background, he's so open to doing all those things. And with help of animation, we could do even more. So there was tons of those things in this film.
Very cool. So Patrick, I was going to ask you a little bit then about Clara's Ghost, which for people listening is sort of a dramedy, drama comedy, kind of weird. And there's a ghost and it's this interesting sort of like a family's getting drunk together in the living room, and it's starring and directed by and written by
Bridie Elliott
mm-hmm. and her family, who you have probably seen on Saturday Night Live. Like mm-hmm. they have this unusual dynamic. It's really cool. So what I'm curious about is how you create tone as an editor. You know, is this something, and, you know, the others can speak to this as well, but especially with Clara's Ghost, where there's like this distinct tones and sometimes multiple, is the tone coming from the footage or are you creating the tone? Like, how does it happen in the edit room?
Sure. When I first read the script for Clara's Ghost, that was the thing that appealed me most about it. I mean, it was one of the best scripts that's ever come across my table. And I think that's because, you know, they say write what you know. And Bridie literally wrote everything that she knows about her family and their house and their dog. And... I knew the Elliott family. I've known Bridie for about 3 years now. I edited her first short film that was in Sundance, and I got to meet Chris and Abby while they were here. So I was a little familiar with them. But we ended up doing a Kickstarter campaign last year, and Bridie had the intuition of shooting the Kickstarter pitch video. Like, this is Bridie Elliott filming her family with a handy cam. And the whole time it's Chris and Paula Elliott sitting on a couch going, Bridie, why are you making us do this? Like, we're not giving you any money, like, blah, blah, blah. It felt real. And I think that's what helped us really sell the pitch of this movie. But through that, I got to learn a little bit more about their personalities. Because Chris, for instance, I mean, I've been watching since I was a kid. I watched him on Get a Life and Letterman and Groundhog Day, which is one of my favorite movies. And a lot of people know him from There's Something About Mary or Scary Movie 2. But, like... Abby, I was a little familiar with from Saturday Night Live, but like I got to know all their personalities, especially Paula, who's the star of our film, from this pitch video. And Paula's never acted before. She had some small stints a while back. And this was essentially Bridie's love letter to her mother by giving her a movie she could finally star in. And because I could really pinpoint their personalities in the script, their characters leapt off the page. So I read every line of dialogue in their voices, and that really sold me on, I could imagine, even though I'm not the DP, I could imagine the angles that I would want to be on and how scenes would play out a certain way. But the tone of the film is what was really a selling point for me, because it's a juxtaposition of this comedy film and a horror film in the same way. And not in like how you would see like a Scary Movie, you know, Scary Movie 2. I should, you know, it's kind of a hard, you know what I mean. The meat of the film, kind of like near the fourth reel, is this upstairs downstairs effect, where everything that's going on upstairs is terrifying. And it's Clara, she's already possessed by the ghost and she's seducing Haley Joel Osment's character, and everything going on downstairs with the rest of the Reynolds family, which is Abby, Bridie, and Chris Elliott, they're drunk and having a seance, and it's just constantly shifting tone back and forth. And what I love about the film is that it literally comes to a point where Clara is standing on the other side of the door getting ready to burn it down and kill her family, and they are on the other side of the door going, Clara, you know, mom, you're being a bitch, maybe you smoke some wacky weed, like it. And so the comedy is just like up to the point where there's a door separating the tension of the tone of the film, and that was super appealing to me. And I mean, I wanted to be a part of the film regardless, but this was the thing. It was like I could really sink my teeth into shifting tones like that. When we were shooting on set, it was also a question of like, well, where are we at here? And like, what's the tone of this scene? Because you're shooting it out of order. And I worked very closely with the DP, Marcus Menser, and we got together and we looked at our shot list every night and, you know, looked for things that might have been missed or how things would lend to the script or things that were mentioned in the script that might have gotten overlooked in the shot list that really helped the film later on. And also just like how to approach it in forms of tone. And I really worked with him to assure him that like the arc of the film and the tone changing was going to work. And I believe it did. I hope we pulled it off. But yeah, it's definitely, it's been hard for me when talking about the film this weekend, because people go, you know, is it a comedy? Is it a horror film? Is it a documentary? Because it's, you know, to Elliot's playing characterizations of themselves. And I say, you know, if anything, it's a mockumentary, because they are just, you know, themselves stripped to a core and then, you know, caricatures.
Yeah, I mean, do the other editors have anything to add about tone? I mean, you know, how you're creating that as an editor or adding to choices made in production and continuing that in the edit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the material really tells you in documentary oftentimes what it wants to be, what it can be, and you can force it to a certain extent or push it in certain directions, but sometimes it's just a matter of observing really well what is it that's in front of you. So, like, you know, we were dealing with all these big themes that we were interested in, and Alan and Jonathan are really nerdy. They would describe themselves as nerdy people. I'm kind of a nerd. Like, we love philosophy. We love talking about big themes and memory and time. And, you know, it just started to get a bit too kind of heady. Mm. But then when we kept going back to Grandma, and in her material, she is like armchair philosopher. She strips things down to such simple wisdoms. And then, you know, I would say like the 2-hour versions of her uncut interviews are like any grandma. She's telling stories. It can be a little bit boring half the time, most of the time, but then she's got these like pearls, and then you just, you know, dissect it down to these sentences where she's hilarious and she doesn't know she's hilarious. And so the tone then, I mean, I worked really hard to try to bring as much humor as possible out of her. And then that started to kind of like shift everything in that direction, so that the moments of humor were really grounding everything. So it wasn't like we were adding comic relief. It was like this kind of play and fun and humor was the driving force, so that in moments that could breathe, then something else could emerge that was like maybe more deeper, interesting.
Very interesting.
With documentary films, oftentimes I feel like styles are the hardest things to come by. So that's like, what you want to do with the material, you know, you can go so many different ways, and that's the hardest thing I find. So when the director has a vision already, and not always happens, so that's the challenge. With the animals, I think from very early stage of the edit, I think the tone shifted slightly in terms of, there are many great funny scenes with the three kids, but because we had to go from that to sort of very violent or some kind of disturbing feeling about the family's dysfunctions and children growing up in those situations, and I think audience kind of felt going too up and down, and we kind of had to kill some babies.
You've been listening to the No Film School podcast. Don't forget to check out part 2 of this conversation. Subscribe to us, rate us on iTunes or whatever platform you use. Listen to Indie Film Weekly every Thursday. And as always, thank you for listening.